Welcome to The Cooler Ring, a podcast for manufacturing marketers brought to you by Cooler Partners. My name is Jeff White. Joining me today is Carmen Perry. How you doing, sir?
Wow, Jeff, I'm blown away. You were just sharing before hitting record here some information on Marilyn Monroe, and I had no idea that you were such a historian. This adds to the web and mountain biking repertoire considerably.
It's about all I've got.
But beyond that, I'm excited for today's show. I think it'll be a fun conversation. I sales is gets a bad rep, you know, and I don't know. I love sales. I love everything about it. I think the best marketers understand that it's in some ways fundamentally a sales function. I think today's conversation is going to be cool.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. And I can quote from The Wolf of Wall Street, you know, pretty much verbatim. So, you know, sales definitely something of huge interest. But I don't think that that's the path that our guest typically takes when he talks about the unstoppable sales method. Joining us today is Sean Casemore. Sean is a keynote speaker, a sales trainer, and an author with a new book coming out on November 18th. Welcome to The Cooler Ring, Sean.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Sean, it's awesome to have you on the show. And not in addition to the extensive resume that Jeff mentioned, you also have a bit of a manufacturing background too, yes?
Absolutely, yeah. I began in manufacturing at the age of 23, for a division of or a company under the Magna blanket. Spent many years there and then moved to another manufacturer, Meritor Suspension Systems at the time, which was under the Arvin Meritor umbrella, and then moved around to a couple other smaller manufacturers post that. So my early career was really focused heavily on kind of a combination of operations, project management, not as much sales in the manufacturing arena. I was in sales prior to that, but spent quite a bit of time.
How did you bring your experience from your previous sales expertise to manufacturing? Like how have you kind of brought that B2B thinking around and crafted the methodology that you're espousing now with the books?
Well, I'll answer that question in two ways. First off, I think if you work in manufacturing and you're not good at selling your ideas, you won't be successful in manufacturing and or you'll not like anything about your job. Because in a manufacturing environment, typically there's a number of people with a lot of ideas and opinions that are, you know, highly educated people. So you got to be good at selling your ideas to move things forward. But what really happened is post that experience, and I've worked in all sorts of different companies over a number of years, but we moved to a place a couple hours north of Toronto, a little bit of a smaller community where I was born and raised, as was my wife. And I said to her, you know, I'd love to be able to start my own business. So I took a look at my past experience and it ended up being sales was of all the careers I'd had, sales is what I enjoyed the most. And I'd sold everything from widgets, manufacturing widgets, which I have done some sales there, I guess, to memberships, which is like selling air. I'm selling you a promise. So you're paying for the promise before I actually deliver anything. And lots in between, professional services, you name it. So long story short, 2010, I started my own. And what's happened since pre-COVID, this began kind of 2018-ish, I did a lot of work with sales teams and was looking at sales processes. And then COVID hit. And I found everybody was throwing out the window their sales process, right? They're moving everything to digital, everything to virtual, no more travel. And, you know, we all knew probably deep down inside that wasn't permanent. So what I did is I took the pre-COVID process and methods that I had seen top performers use. I sprinkled in what happened in COVID. And then, of course, post-COVID when we've leveled out. And I created what I call the Unstoppable Sales Method, which if you're to pick up the book, it incorporates, there's a section on marketing. Because in my world, sales and marketing go hand in hand. If you're in marketing, and marketing people may not like me saying this, but I mean, the goal is to generate leads that you then pass off to sales, and sales goes and closes those leads as long as they're qualified. So it really is a partnership, and the book speaks to that. I have many people in sales that buy the book and say, well, there's some stuff in here about marketing. Why is that important? I said, well, you should at least know what's going on and how marketing can support you, because you can partner with them. They can make your life a lot easier. So that's kind of a long-winded how the whole process of methodology came to play. And each and every day now, I continue to write books because there's elements of that that continue to evolve and change even in today's environment. So,
you know, it's important to point out, I think one of the things that some marketers maybe get their the hair on their neck stand up a little bit at the notion of their job is to generate leads for sales, or they think it's also, they would just say, yes, but there's also X, Y, or Z to it. But even those type of reputational things, the most advanced brand strategy as an example, where does it actually, where does the rubber meet the road? Actually, an increased close rates for the sales team. If you have that really powerful brand, well, that actually shows up. I mean, salespeople might like to take full responsibility for the close rate, but it's not just the salespeople that are responsible for that close.
Exactly. And depending on the kind of manufacturer you're, you know, a small manufacturer, if you're lucky, they're going to have somebody outsourcing doing the marketing. Large organization, you're going to have a large team potentially. But I find regardless of size, there's a disconnect. I mean, if manufacturers wanted more sales and more leads to their ideal clients, probably the fastest method, aside from, you know, improving your process, is to take those two groups, those two departments, and have them work more closely together. Having conversations, marketing, getting intel about what sales came across at a recent show they attended, so that they can use geo-targeting potentially for future shows, insights about what customers are saying and how they can change their language to better align with what sales is hearing in their conversations. Like that's one of the most powerful and I think overlooked methods to generate sales. And again, my book doesn't dive too much into it, but I do acknowledge the fact that, I mean, marketing is key to being successful in sales, and it's part of the process. You've got to have a good front end, so to speak.
Now, Sean, one of the things that you said that really jumped out to me in an earlier conversation when we were talking about this, you know, the fact is most manufacturers are selling to other manufacturers. And so they often speak very similar languages in that way, and it's an interesting sector to counsel into as a result, I find. And the thing that you said to me is you said, yeah, they almost all want to sell the old way, but they're probably buying in the new way. And yeah, man, I can't get that out of my head.
Well, I'd suggest maybe you need more things to think about. But
this is not true.
I'm kidding.
Not true. There's a lot going on in there.
what we were discussing at the time, and this will probably come as no surprise to your listeners, is how I'll say prospects or buyers are buying today. And when I say buyers, it could be a purchasing agent, it could be an operations director, it could be a production manager, maintenance manager, doesn't matter. How they're buying today is different than pre-COVID. What's significantly different is how much time they're spending researching before they buy. Now, that research is a combination of online, so they're looking at websites, they're looking at certain different consolidation platforms like a Thomasnet, for example, potentially LinkedIn. They're going online, they're doing a little bit of offline research as they have in the past. They picked up some information at an event. But a lot of time is being spent researching. What the studies have shown is the amount of time given to the salesperson in that buy cycle, meaning I think I need something, let me do some research, let me talk to sales, let me come up with some, you know, get some quotes and make a decision. That was in 2021, I think it was, Gartner published that it was around 17% of the total time. And I would suggest, although I don't think that study's been updated, I think we can all agree that less and less time is being spent with sales, more and more time in the research end of things. Well, who influences the research? It's marketing, right? Marketing is putting together the marketing materials. They're responsible for the website, the social media content, all of that. And so the other aspect of that is we've got to start to consider, if all that time is being spent researching, very little time is given to sales, how can sales get and keep the attention of the people they're trying to sell to? And that is becoming the challenge. And just sending you more emails when you're not responding to emails is not the way to go. Just sending you more LinkedIn messages when you're not responding to LinkedIn is not the way to go. But unfortunately, many salespeople, know, they're kind of coming back to, well, this is how I used to do it. I used to send emails and people responded. They're not responding. I guess I'll try more emails. And in some cases, all you're doing is annoying people. So sales professionals need to start to think out of the box about how they interact. And again, I think partnering with or being working more closely with marketing can help enable this, you know, connection, because so much time is being spent on research that marketing is oftentimes has their finger on.
Yeah, I appreciate the role for marketing in that, but I want to really dive into what the salespeople can change, because my goodness, a lot of them might tell you, you know, Sean, those are the only tools we have in our bag. I mean, we can show up at their office and try to wait until they'll see us. We can call them or we can email them.
Well, you can also, I mean, LinkedIn, I'm finding, and all the sales teams I work with globally, LinkedIn is increasingly becoming, for some, not all, the new inbox. And what I mean by for some, not all, is if the three of us here were here today, we could almost split it in thirds. And we could say that, you know, 33% of us, so one of us is okay using email to talk to an outside salesperson. One of us is okay receiving a phone call, and somebody else would be okay receiving a LinkedIn message. You know, so what salespeople are doing and should be doing is expanding their toolbox as far as the tools to connect with people. So the old school stuff, you know, people are still attending events. And in fact, this year, more than ever, in multiple different industries that I've been working with, they're saying that events are back in a big way. Like, people are showing up and they're willing to engage. They're not hiding in the corner. That, you know, they want to talk to salespeople. So events can be highly effective, networking, trade shows, etc. Obviously, email, it still works. Less and less effective, but it still works. Telephone, showing up, stopping by their facility, right? Getting a referral in, using LinkedIn. I'm not a fan of text messaging when it's cold and you don't know me, but I mean, if we've met at a trade show and I've got your number and nothing else is working. And what I tell salespeople they need to think of is when they're reaching out to somebody they don't know, look at it as a matter of, okay, there's, what did we just list off there? There's six different ways, let's say, to connect with somebody. We've listed, I think, close to six. As I'm reaching out, I want to try each of these different channels. And whatever channel works, meaning you respond to me, that's the channel that you've now identified, I'm okay talking to you on this channel. And then you stick with it. But again, a lot of times what we do is we go back to what we know. So email used to work. It's not now. I'll just do more of them. And that's not working. And in fact, it can be hurting your reputation as a salesperson if you're blasting out all these emails that nobody's getting back to you on. I mean, that's a sign, right?
Or as an organization, you could lose domain authority and not be able to send emails at all anymore.
100%. And it's funny, I was working with, speaking with a gentleman two weeks ago, it's in the UK. We've done some work together this year. And he was working with his marketing team, sending out the odd, I would say, blast, right? They got a big list together and he's sending out some information. And based on his experience, he's been in this industry quite a long time. And he has a big network. And so I said to him last year, I'm like, I would stop all that stuff and just double down on connecting with people, having conversations, have a coffee, have lunch, have a Zoom call, Teams call, telephone call, doesn't matter. Just start connecting with people and having conversations versus spending all this time trying to create these massive emails that aren't achieving anything for you. So he did that last year. And I just spoke with him. His year is growing. I mean, it's not where he wanted to be, but it's definitely better than where he was last year. But the opportunities in his pipeline are huge. Like, as far as 2026 is going to be a banger, if I can say that, as my son would say. And from that, he's enjoying what he's doing because he's getting back to what he likes, which is talking to people, not putting together email blasts. And he says, you know, I've given up those altogether because they don't work. And I said, yeah, but if I would have told you those don't work, you should do this other stuff, you would have said, No, they work, right? Because I get one response to my 2,000 emails that goes nowhere. So I'm not suggesting they don't work, but they have a place depending on the industry and sector. And what salespeople need to do is their time is valuable. So don't waste it on stuff that doesn't work. Focus on what does work, what has worked, what is working. But when you're reaching out, think about all those different channels that you should connect with everybody on. Because it's just like fishing. If you throw the bait in and you get nothing, you just keep tossing it back in over. And I guess that's fly fishing, right? Eventually, I would think you change the bait. You say, oh, that didn't work. Let me try something else. It's that concept.
Yeah, I think so. There are people selling into different sectors that would say, you know, LinkedIn's getting there too, you know, in terms of you're starting to think that every time you get a message on LinkedIn, it's from somebody trying to sell you something. And therefore, it's getting to be less effective. I know people are... some folks are advocating, you know, shifting to video messages or audio messages on LinkedIn as a way of maybe cutting through that noise. But then the second that you hear that, the next comment that you hear is, here's a way to automate that for your 2,000 prospects. So, you know, Sean, are we at the place where, okay, everything that's old is new again, and the thing that we won't be able to duplicate anytime soon is that power of personal connection and, like you said, going out to lunch or what have you? Or are we actually pioneering new ways that work at all in the world of sales?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's always new, well, depending on who's paying for the ad that you read, there's apparently technology that will replace salespeople. I haven't seen any that actually works yet, but the ads will tell you otherwise. But, you know, it comes back to what the rest of our life is like. I mean, if you take a look at today and how you communicate personally today versus, you know, your age is probably somewhere around mine. So I can remember selling at age 11, going door to door, right? Trying to sell my lawn mowing services. And if I didn't go door to door, there was one other, well, I could go door to door and see them, drop something off or call them. That was it. When I sold cars in my early 20s, the dealer did ads. So they could only run ads in the newspaper and on the local radio station. And then the manufacturers did them on TV. That was it. That was the opportunity for running ads. There was nothing else. And me selling, if you didn't show up, if I knew your address, I could go see you, but I didn't. So I really had a couple options. I could call you. I could leave you a voicemail when I call. I could email you because email was just starting, but many people weren't using it or you wouldn't get back to me for 3 months. But look at today. So I know people that are still in the car business, right? So they're getting leads from their website. They're getting people emailing them. They're getting people texting them. They're getting people calling them. They're getting people stopping. So the ways in which we communicate have tripled, if not more so. And in selling is about communication. It's about interacting with people. It's about getting their attention. So just as it pertains to communication, there are so many different tools we need to have in the toolbox. And I've not found many scenarios where something doesn't work. The challenge is each person we're connecting with will have their own bias for how they prefer to talk to an outside salesperson. And that's going to depend on their own priorities. So if you're a CEO and you're busy and you get 250 emails a day, you're probably not answering my email in your inbox because it's buried and you're prioritizing every step of the day to get through those emails. But if I send you in something on LinkedIn, maybe. But to your point then, what am I sending you? Because that's the next step, which is adding value. We've all been pitched irrelevant messages constantly on all platforms, text messages, people trying to give me a job. I saw your profile. I want to offer you a job opportunity. I'm like, that's great. Clearly you didn't see my profile because I've worked for myself for 15 years. Like, you know what I mean? Just complete crap. We all get them, but there's still texts that come through that I respond to because the information is relevant to me and it adds value. It's insightful. It's interesting. It's provocative. Those are the ingredients. When you start to look at the channels, the next step is what could I share that would be of interest and helpful to you and a bit provocative. So it gets you thinking, right? So these are the steps that I build out in my newest book, which is a kind of a component of the Unstoppable Sales Machine, is the Unstoppable Sales Prospecting System. And it breaks down all these different steps you need to go through to prospect effectively today. It's a lot to it.
I have to think, I mean, you know, what you've been talking about all along is this notion that, you know, really sales is a team sport. You know, you're going to have, you know, your marketing team, your operations, your engineers to give you information about what it is that the new product does or all of these different things. And I remember 25 years ago, a book came out by a gentleman by the name of Richard Saul Wurman. And he's actually one of the founders of TED, the TED Talks that we all know and love. And it was called Information Anxiety. And the whole notion behind this was that, you know, 25 years ago, we're being bombarded by messages all the time. Now, exponentially more messages now, you know, and you talk about having, you know, sending something that's you know, interesting and relevant and, you know, useful to the prospect. To me, this is really where the marketing team probably comes into play a bit, is in, you know, helping to take that creative approach and create the things that are actually going to cut through that so that when you do receive it, it stands out from all of the other stuff that you're getting. How, maybe I'll phrase it another way. What examples have you maybe seen of the types of things that have truly cut through the noise that perhaps marketers and salespeople have come up with together to get a prospect to truly stand up and notice?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Now, it's going to depend on the industry, obviously, but I was thinking as you're speaking, I just finished up a 2-day, I call it a sales camp with a team. And we had the operational folks and the sales folks in the room. And we brought in the gentleman responsible for marketing because, again, they have a key role to play as it pertains to, you know, building sales. So I call those items that are of interest or value, value assets. Creativity is not my forte, but I call them value assets. And the idea being they've got to be something that's of value or interest to the person that you're providing them to. Now, what those can be differs. It differs depending on the company, the industry, the sector, the person, the title. So if I'm trying to sell into a manufacturer, and let's assume for a moment that I'm selling something to that the production manager, plant manager would be interested in, they might bring into their circle, because this is the other thing studies have found, more and more decisions are made by multiple people, not one. So you've always got to be thinking when I'm reaching out, I'm not just reaching out to one person, I'm reaching out to multiple. So let's assume the plant manager is going to be part of this decision. Possibly somebody in HR might sit in on this and have a say. Maybe there's somebody in production that's going to be part of this as well. And let's throw purchasing into that loop. So there's four people. What would each of those people value that will be of interest to them? Now, in my initial outreach, I would pursue, as I said, all four people, but the goal is not to throw a bunch of stuff at them. So you might reach out and you might say, in the outreach, here's something that I came across, a recent study at an event, and the ABC event I was at last month, that I'm not sure if you grabbed a copy, but it identifies companies in your specific area, and I thought you might be of interest to you. Again, that's not a good intro, but you get the idea. So it can be something that I find that I think they'd want to read or review. I find a lot of more executive folks are interested in benchmarking studies and surveys that show how they're performing or how their department is performing against others. It might be something personal. So somebody asked me recently, they said, Sean, the book that's coming out this month is my 8th book. They said, wow, you must love, sorry, my 7th book. They said, you must love writing books. And I said, no, I do not. And they said, well, why do you write so many books? I said, why do you think? It's a value asset. People ask me, well, what's your system for prospecting? So there's a couple of things I can do. I can talk about it. I can create a PDF, but doesn't every other sales trainer do those two things? But what if I wrote a book on it? How many people do you know in sales training world that have written a book on prospecting? And not like a commercially published book. So that to me is a value asset. I write it and I give them out like candy to the appropriate people. So you've got to know who you're trying to pursue and what's of interest to them. And here's the key. If you don't know, as you're meeting up with them, talking and having conversations with existing clients, you ask them, what's a resource or something that would be helpful to you? If you didn't know me today, we weren't working together. What's something that you would find helpful or useful in trying to identify who to work with a service like ours? So your existing clients or customers will tell you. And then you develop those. But just you don't want them to be boring. I guess I'll leave it with that because too many people put together plain old PDF type, seen it before stuff. And that's not the goal. It's got to be different. It's got to be unique.
Sean, you said that you're not, you're saying creativity is not your forte. You call them value assets. I'm going to take a task on that a little bit because I actually think the name value assets is really, really helpful in helping shape that up. Like I think an awful lot of marketing team members, marketing organizations, if they were into this conversation initially, they would be hearing, okay, it's sales enablement assets is what I'm creating. I'm creating things that the sales team can use. So then they may think, okay, well, they can use spec sheets or application guides, use case examples, thought leadership pieces. All of those things are they're valuable things. So I'm not suggesting they're not value assets, but they all have a fairly heavy lift associated with them. And what doesn't have a heavy lift associated with it is, hey, I saw this article that you might be interested in that I had nothing to do with. It's from another. And I I really love this value asset framing, because I think if marketing organizations, marketing teams thought about it that way, they would inventory assets that could help sales, and those assets would be more broad.
Yeah.
And a number of things that they could include in them would be a heck of a lot easier to, because in some cases they wouldn't have to create them. They just need to simply identify them and catalog them so they can be used by the sales team accordingly. There's something really kind of really compelling at the heart of what you're saying there, that I think you were short selling by saying value assets wasn't particularly creative.
As long as I'm selling, that's the main thing. Here's the other side of it, though, and you hit the nail on the head, I think, when it comes to if the initial thought is, well, I'm already creating these value assets. We're creating an annual report. We're doing a video series, a thought leadership video series. If you look around and you've got competitors doing something similar, then to me, it's not a value asset. Right? Because when you look at value assets in my workshops, what I have sales teams do is I say, okay, you tell me, you list off a bunch of stuff you think a prospect would value. So they come up with the standard, right? It's a report, it's an assessment, it's an article, it's whatever. And I say, okay, now categorize that. Which of those are competitive? Meaning, yeah, they probably get that from others. And which of these things are a little bit unique? So it's not something they've seen before, or it's rare, or maybe they don't see it at all. And there's rarely anything in the right-hand column. And when I force them to start to think about what could those things be, people get antsy and irritable, because it requires thought. It requires effort to sit down and say, okay, what can I give you that's going to be helpful to you, but you don't see it every day? Because that's where the rubber hits the road, insert cliche saying here, meaning that I send you something, I share something with you, and you go, wow, this has been helpful. I haven't seen this before. As soon as that happens, are you going to want to call me when there's a need? 100%. And now what I'm doing, and you'll hear this phrase a lot, I'm now positioning myself as a trusted advisor, or at least somebody who's building trust with you, because I gave you this thing you haven't seen before. It's helpful to you, and no obligation on your side. So to me, it really is. And this is how, if you take a look at the studies of how people are buying today, they're overwhelmed with information. So they're doing research. The result of the research, at least one of the outcomes, is they're overwhelmed. So when they get overwhelmed, then they tend to make a decision. And I can't remember the percentage, but it's a very high percentage of people that regret once they do make the buy decision, because they get overwhelmed and say, forget it, let's just go with Sean. And then like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Maybe I should have researched more, or they find new information. So when you start to differentiate and set yourself apart in what you're sharing with them, you become somebody they trust, meaning the competition goes away, because now they trust you and you can have a deeper conversation about their needs.
Have you, and a lot of this, of course, we're talking about prospecting and getting in that door initially. I think, and there's kind of two types of trusted advisors. Those that become really lazy farmers and basically take the relationship for granted until it no longer exists. And then there are others that seem to find a way to continue to earn that trust. Is that something that you've covered in your work, Sean, about how sales teams kind of maybe need to approach that?
Yeah, I'll give you a short response and then maybe a little bit of a deeper one. So the short response is this, that if you look at many salespeople today, they are good account managers. Once they have a relationship, they're fantastic at nurturing it and maintaining it and even growing it. And there's pros and cons to that, but there's not a lot of hunters out there. And what I say to a lot of executives, I speak at a lot of Vistage type meetings here in Canada, we have tech meetings. And I say to CEOs, have you had a hard time hiring skilled trades lately? And if they've been in manufacturing, especially, they're all like, oh yeah, very hard. I said, have you tried hiring a good hunting type salesperson lately? And the collective agreement is typically, if they have, they're like, yeah, it's even harder than skilled trades. So they're hard to find people that like to do this. So that's step one. Let's understand the market. If you have somebody like that, hold on to them tight. But the other side of the coin here is that when it comes to, I think everybody gets lazy. I mean, do you enjoy getting up in the morning and making 10 cold calls? Anybody that tells you every day, I love doing that, I don't know. I like doing it. I love doing it. But if I don't do it, I don't eat. So the indirect solution there, I think at least, and if you've got manufacturers and you want hunters, the compensation package needs to encourage them to continue to hunt. And what can often happen is that doesn't happen, meaning there's maybe a high commission percentage that's ongoing for a lengthy period of time that rewards just maintaining customers. And then, you know, most people go into a job and say, I need to make X. So if I'm making X off current accounts, what's the motivation, at least financially, to go and do more? And I'm not saying it's all about finances, but it's a key component to, you know, people that are hungry. I need to eat, so I hunt whether I like it or not. I'm not feeling well today, but guess what? I'm making 10 calls. Because if I don't, we don't eat, and I can't get medication to feel better, right? So there's a little bit of other thing. And you know, younger generations today hunt in different ways than you or I probably have or did. Not to say those aren't effective, but trying to get younger generations to go see somebody, for many, they're not as comfortable doing that. They haven't grown up in that environment. So sales is changing, buyers are changing, and hence we've got to keep evolving with times and look at the demographic, the people we're selling to, and make adjustments accordingly.
I'd say if you enjoy greatly making 10 sales calls a day, you're probably slightly psychotic.
I know people that love it. And I've tried to, like, you love it? Like, and they're like, yeah, I love it. Now, again, it happens. And, you know, but there are probably, to me, I'm a process thinker. So when I think about sales, I think about steps to take that need to be repeated. Oftentimes those people are just, they just like talking to people and connecting with people, right? They love it. And so they're successful as a result because they've got a strong team behind them that they can have their conversation, pass it along, move on to the next one. So as long as the system's built properly, that can work. But yeah, you've really got to be cognizant of how you design the roles and what your expectations are. Be clear of those too. A lot of people are hired today and nobody says, you know, they'd say in the interview, I'm looking for a hunter, but it never comes up again. There's no measures of success. There's no 30, 60, 90 day plan to demonstrate the hunting. And then I get you into onboarding that consumes a month. And then I expect you to go out and hunt. Well, you've been comfortable now. You're sitting in the office every day. You got to know people. You have a warm cup of coffee. You don't need to make calls. Now I want you to start. Like, you just have to be careful.
I think that's really interesting advice. It's not where I thought we were going with that response, but
maybe too deep.
I think it's, you know, there's a lot of people out there that complain about the hunting performance of their sales organization, but they have not structured it for hunting at all. It's basically exactly what you're saying is correct. I mean, I've just seen it an awful lot. And then the other thing I find on the farming side is, will be people who feel like they earn the right for the next piece of business because of a relationship, because they know somebody's son's birthday or when the anniversary happens. And, you know, I think the smarter money is on, you know, how to create a learning relationship with that prospect in a way that you both become smarter in your roles over time. But you're a key part of why that person's become smarter in their role. That's a harder, talking about value assets, making yourself that kind of a value asset would be fairly difficult, but it is, I think, something to aspire to.
I like that.
Something I'll throw at you that so in some of the coaching I've done, I run across people that are really friendly, love connecting with people, but don't make a lot of sales. And oftentimes it's because, so that as much as it's a pause, it's a strength to want to make friends with people. That's okay if that's helping you build a relationship. But then sometimes that can skew your desire or your ability to ask for the sale. So what I often tell people in a coaching relationship is there's a difference between being a friend and being friendly.
I'd be remiss now not to work in a quote from No Country for Old Men when he says to Woody Harrelson, what does that make me, your buddy? When he tells them that they're both in Nam. Yeah. Exactly. More importantly, where's a satchel full of money? It's kind of the main part
of that question. That's what we're all looking for. Yeah.
Sean, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing your experience with us today. We've loved having you on the show. And I would encourage folks listening to go out and pick up that prospecting book, The Unstoppable Sales Model
Prospecting System. The Unstoppable Sales Prospecting System.
There you go. That's part of the Unstoppable Sales Model. I'll get it right eventually, Sean.
Available November 18th on Amazon, isn't it, Sean?
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. And they can also, If they want to visit my website, there's lots of other free resources there as well. There's tips. I do a couple blogs a month, all that kind of stuff at SeanCaseMar.com.
Cool. We'll link that up. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks.